Welcome. I'm Chuck Missler, and I'm pleased to be able to provide the introduction to a conference of such intense interest to both our Jewish friends and our Christian associates. The purpose of this conference, the primary purpose of this conference is, of course, to present an update on the status of the preparations to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. But some supplemental purposes, of course, is to help establish a basis of improved relationship and understanding between Israel and the Christian biblical community. We seek an improved awareness among Christians of our common heritage in the Torah, the Tanakh, and the associated background. Many people ask me, why all the focus on the temple? Well, first of all, it's important for us to realize that Israel has been without their temple for over 1,900 years. And of course, the whole basis of Judaism is based in the Torah and the temple practices. The Hebrew sage Maimonides, over 800 years ago, highlighted that the rebuilding of the temple is an imperative in Talmudic Judaism. We as Christians are interested because we take note of the fact that at least three times, in the New Testament, there are prophetic allusions to the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. And it's this ultimate rebuilding that quickens our pulse as we realize that God is moving. As we look at Israel, it's also probably the next major milestone in Israel's restoration. We're all aware of the establishment of the nation Israel on May 14th of 1948, and we all took note that Israel regained its control of biblical Jerusalem in June of 1967. And so we have the nation, we have the city. The next major milestone is, of course, the rebuilding of the temple. Some of you may be wondering, how did I get involved in this and why am I up here? Well, this goes back over 10 years. As most of you may be aware, that archaeology is basically a spade and shovel technology. But, of course, a number of us who have been involved in advanced technologies and defense industries and what have you have had the suspicion that many of the discoveries and techniques that have been developed in other scientific fields could have a profound impact on the archaeological practices, which, of course, is of such intense interest, especially here in Israel. Back in the early 1980s, Chuck Smith of Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa and myself had the privilege of providing the funding for Lambert Dolphin and his team at the Radiophysics Laboratory at SRI International to explore the potential application of a number of these advanced techniques to archaeology here in Israel. They had established quite a reputation for themselves and some other archaeological ventures applying these interesting techniques. For example, ground-penetrating radar. It comes as a surprise to many technologists that radar, if used in the proper manner, can, on occasion, penetrate the ground 10 or 20 meters. And there's also, of course, seismic sensors of all kinds. There's acoustical holography is another technique, microgravity sensors, and also resistivity studies, all these, and infrared thermographic studies. All of these techniques provide clues as to what might be lying under the ground. And this can all be done, of course, they're regarded as non-invasive techniques. And, of course, because of the political problems on the Temple Mount, these techniques have even an added emphasis as giving us some insights as to what really lies below this famed piece of real estate. It was through these early developments over a decade ago that we were able to develop lasting friendships with Stanley Goldfoot and Dr. Asher Kaufman and the others that you will hear during this conference. In fact, I'll never forget the delightful surprise that Nan and I had when we discovered a very generous acknowledgement in Dr. Kaufman's landmark book on the temple area. It was from this background that our book, The Coming Temple, was published a couple of years ago. In fact, it was through the graciousness of Tuvia Segev that we were able to include some of his provocative findings in that early publication. And so it is with particular excitement that we look forward to the both Dr. Kaufman's presentation and Tuvia Segee's presentation in the conference this year. Before we get into it, it might be provocative to stand back a little bit and get a little background on what we so glibly call the temple. It comes as a real surprise to many biblical scholars to realize that the ideas that we associate with the temple may have had their real roots back in the Garden of Eden. The whole story of Cain and Abel in Genesis 4 carries implications that can only be understood if you realize that there was specific sacrificial instructions instituted to Adam and Eve in the garden. We get clues of this where we speak of Abel's offering and the fat thereof. There's little hints and phrases that we take for granted, forgetting, of course, that these ideas echo the instructions that indeed were codified under the laws of Moses. When we get to the story of Noah and the flood, it's fun to ask people how many of each kind of animal, did Noah take into the ark? And, of course, the glib answer is two of each, except, of course, if you look carefully, it's seven of the clean and two of the unclean. Well, that sounds great, except how did Noah know what was clean and unclean? Those are ritual purity definitions that we associate with the Torah, that is the book of Leviticus and so forth. Clearly, though, we begin to realize that these ideas, while codified under the laws of Moses, much later, had their roots in far earlier commitments. And, of course, as we go forward in the book of Genesis, we get to chapter 22, the Akedah, the famous offering of Isaac by his father Abraham on Mount Moriah. And, of course, it's that famed incident in Genesis 22 that leads to the traditions, both in Judaism as well as Islam, that Mount Moriah and Abram's offering there is related to the temple. And, of course, some of us suspect that Abraham probably offered Isaac actually on the peak of the mount, not at the particular place the temple is, but then again, that's an area for the experts to share their views. And as I think some of my Jewish friends have pointed out to me, when you're in Israel, if you have two Jews, you've got three opinions. So many of these things we treat with a rather light touch. But the whole traditional view of the temple being on the site of Mount Moriah will, of course, be amplified by Dr. Dan Bahat, the chief archaeologist of the Jerusalem district, when he makes his presentation during this conference. The real theme of the temple, though, tends to take its more codified form as we encounter Mount Sinai, and not only the giving of the Ten Commandments by Moses, but also the Lord providing him very detailed instructions for this portable sanctuary, the tabernacle, as we call it. A place that was specifically established so that God had a way to dwell among his people. And, of course, it's an absolute must to Christians, not just Jews, to really do a detailed study of the tabernacle, because so much throughout the rest of the Bible hangs on an understanding of the tabernacle and its symbolism and so forth. And for over four centuries, it provided the place of worship for the nation. And until we get, of course, to the days of David and his son Solomon, where, of course, Solomon builds a permanent structure on Mount Moriah, which is known in scholastic circles as the First Temple. And that served for a time, and then, of course, we encounter that period of history where God used the nation Babylon as his instrument of judgment. And they descend upon the house of Judah, and specifically the city of Jerusalem, and they destroy the temple. It's a provocative observation we need to be sensitive to, that the temple was destroyed on a peculiar day on the Jewish calendar. Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, was the day that Nebuchadnezzar and his armies destroyed the temple. And, of course, they go into the famed 70 years captivity, ultimately to be returned to the land under the leadership of Zerubbabel. And we have the rebuilding, although in modest terms, of what we glibly call the second temple, the subsequent temple. And as the history unfolds, of course, under the Seleucid Empire, we have a leader by the name of Antiochus IV, who called himself Epiphanes, who takes it upon himself to desecrate that temple. And the desecration of that temple, of course, leads to the famed Maccabean Revolt. And the period of history that's commonly called the period of the Hasmoneans. And of course, as the history continues, ultimately Rome conquers the Greek Empire or its remnants and establishes not a Jew but an Edomite by the name of Herod to be the king of Judea. And Herod, as we all know, embarks on a massive building program, including Masada and many other things. But of interest here, of course, is his elaborate expansion of the temple that that Zerubbabel built under the leadership of Ezra, Nehemiah, and so forth. It is Herod's temple. Most of us, standing afar, would look at it as a third temple, but by common parlance, it is called the Second Temple. It's viewed as simply a modification or expansion, if you will, of the one that was built after the return from the Babylonian captivity. The Herodian Temple, of course, captures our interest as New Testament Christians because it, of course, is the edifice that was standing during the ministry of Jesus. And so we watch that, of course, with great interest. And as we are all aware, subsequent to his crucifixion, as predicted, the Romans lay it down. Titus Vespasian and the 5th, 10th, 12th, and 15th Roman legions surround the city, slaughter over 1 million inhabitants, men, women, and children, in the famed destruction of Jerusalem from 69 and 70 A.D. And we're indebted to Flavius Josephus for his eyewitness accounts of that very critical historic period in 70 A.D. Provocative for all of us to watch and realize that the day on the Hebrew calendar again is Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. How fascinating it is, how accommodating it is of these Gentile conquerors to conform to such a precise calendar. And I'm being a little facetious, of course, but obviously Tisha B'Av is both a day of great mourning in Judaism, but it's also a strange day of mourning because it includes a element of joy in the knowledge that the temple will again be rebuilt. Another piece of history often overlooked, especially by Christian students, is the subsequent history after the Romans destroyed it in 70 A.D. There's another revolt that occurs under Bar Kokhba in about 132 A.D., in which Bar Kokhba leads a revolt, successfully slaughters the Roman 12th Legion, something they never recover from, and for 3 years successfully has relieved the yoke of Rome. It takes the Romans about 3 years to get their act together, and of course they ultimately crush that. And they decide that they're going to level the entire city of Jerusalem. And they build a Roman city, Aela Capitolina, on top of that. And they erect a temple to Jupiter on the very site of the original Jewish temple. Now, this piece of history will turn out to be very, very critical to have in perspective when Tuvia Segev presents some of his provocative studies. The temple to Jupiter, of course, that the Romans built a few centuries later, built about 140 A.D., about a century and a half later, it gets converted to Christian use as Constantine declares that Christianity is the official religion of the Roman Empire. And, of course, the subsequent Muslim conquest several centuries later causes those structures, apparently, which had been converted to Christian use, to become Muslim structures. And the possibility exists that the existing structures on the Temple Mount, namely the Dome of the Rock and also the Al-Aqsa Mosque, possibly may be resident on the very foundations of the Temple of Jupiter. If that's correct, then that has some profound implications to our understanding of the Temple Mount area. This background will be useful to you as Tuvia Segev presents his very provocative insights. But anyway, let's stand back and look at the current status. We're sitting here today with the recognition that Israel has been regathered. We need to be cognizant of what the prophet Isaiah highlights for us in chapter 11, verse 11, where he points out when God says, "When I regather Israel the second time." The first time, of course, is after Babylon. They went into 70 years captivity under Nebuchadnezzar, and just as Jeremiah predicted and Daniel observed and counted on, they were returned to their land 70 years. In fact, some analysts even figure it to the very day. But Isaiah is talking about the regathering not from a single country, but from all nations, and he's talking about regathering the second time. And our pulse quickens as we realize that what he's talking about is what we have observed over the last several decades as Israel is reestablished as a nation and regathered. We also take joy and excitement as we realize that just as God predicted, Israel would regain biblical Jerusalem. And that, of course, has occurred on June 6th of 1967. Many of us were surprised and disheartened when we learned that Moshe Dayan, about 10 days later, yielded back to the Muslim High Council, Supreme Council, the Waqf, the administrative control of the most sacred spot to Judaism, namely the Temple Mount. This strange piece of real estate is obviously venerated by the three monotheistic religions on the planet Earth. Islam, of course, venerates it for its purposes. Israel, of course, looks to it for all the obvious reasons from the Bible and from David and Solomon and the rest. And we as Christians from that common heritage also look to it as a very special place. So it's interesting that this peculiar piece of real estate is so critical. But it's also critical to the God of Israel. And so we watch with great interest as we recognize the obvious political problems that lie ahead. But we approach these problems with a strange sense of confidence because we know that God means what he says and says what he means. And while we don't know how it's going to all evolve, we do know that the temple will be rebuilt on the site. And it's exciting as we meet in these series of meetings, the next several days, to realize the preparations to rebuild the temple have begun. Dan Bahat will, of course, review the background, the archaeological background of the area. Rabbi Chaim Richman from the Temple Institute will bring us up to date on the many, many things that they've undertaken and accomplished in preparation, not as educational things, but to actually serve in the temple. And we'll learn about the several yeshivas that have several hundred young men in training to serve in the temple. So it's not a little political exercise. It's not educational gesture. You'll discover that all kinds of groups, each with their own particular agendas, are all pulling together with this common objective, the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. So, as we gather and we have a chance to hear these presentations, and we also have a chance to ask questions and also meet with them informally in the breaks and so forth, let's celebrate our common biblical heritage in the Torah and in the prophets. And it's important for the Christians among us not to dwell on our well-known differences and thus deny us a basis of friendship and understanding with our Jewish brethren. I'm reminded, my wife and I were attending Fiddler on the Roof, a well-known play, and I can remember during the intermission, there was a couple in front of us that turned to us and looked at my blonde wife and our two blonde sons that were sitting there and says, we're really puzzled because, she says, we were raised in an Orthodox home and we have trouble sometimes following the humor and the subtleties of this colorful play. How can you relate to this? You're not Jewish, are you? And we said, no, we're not Jewish, but the God we worship is. And that opened a whole conversation in which we tried to explain why we as Christians have such a deep heart for all things that are Jewish, as we try to understand more our common heritage. I remember last year at the conference, one of the climactic keynote addresses of the conference is given by Gershon Solomon, who is the leader of the Temple Mount Faithful. Delightful guy, and we just had such a he was scheduled to speak for about an hour, and I think we kept him there for 3 hours, and it was, I don't think it was a dry eye in the place. He just touched our hearts, and I think we touched his. But I remember it was kind of interesting because he was surprised to realize that we look to our Messiah as also a son of David. That surprised him. And I kidded him. I says, actually, I think we have more in common than most people realize. In fact, when he comes, we'll just ask him whether it's his first or his second visit. Let's enjoy the fruits of this committed and diverse group of experts that you're going to hear in the next several days. And let's just prepare ourselves to observe what the God of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov is going to be doing in his land. Shalom.